Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. The U.S. Senate has invited Julian Assange to testify in Russian investigation. Julian Assange has been asked to testify before the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee as part of their Russia investigation, according to a letter posted by the official WikiLeaks Twitter account. The letter reads in part, quote, "As part of the inquiry, the committee requests that you make yourself available for a closed interview with bipartisan committee staff at a mutually agreeable time and location," end quote. WikiLeaks says their legal team is, quote, "considering the offer, but testimony must conform to a high ethical standard," end quote. After which, the whistleblower organization added a tweet linking to a list of 10 Democratic senators who demanded in late June that Assange's asylum be revoked, which, by the way, is in violation of international law. You hear that? Democratic senators in violation of international law. And here are the names: Robert Menendez, Richard Blumenthal, Michael Bennett, Joe Manchin III, Dianne Feinstein, Mark Warner, Gene Shaheen, Chris Coons, Edward Markey, and Richard Durbin. Here's the thing, folks. You can't make decisions, as the Democrats are doing, for the sake of political expediency on the front end and then try to claim the moral high ground on the back end. You have to play the game straight at all times. If you do that, you'll always win in the end. New York GOP Rep. Chris Collins arrested in insider trading charges. Representative Chris Collins from New York, Republican, has been arrested on insider trading charges lodged by the Justice Department. The indictment also charges Collins' son, Cameron Collins, as well as his father, the father of his fiancée, Stephen Zarsky. In June 27, Collins allegedly passed non-public information about Innates, which is an Australian drug company, about their drug trial results to his son in order to make timely trades in Innate stock and tip others, the indictment alleges. The indictment alleges Collins scrambled to call his son from the White House lawn and tell him non-public information about the failed drug trial, which they both owned shares. We'll have to see how this plays out. Some races today are too close to call this evening after voters hit the polls in several states yesterday. In Ohio's 12th, too close to call. In Kansas' race for governor, too close to call. Missouri voters decided against making Missouri a right-to-work state, and Rashida Tlaib is the first Muslim woman to be elected to Congress after winning Michigan Democratic primary. We'll get to those stories in much deeper context in a few minutes. China announces 25% tariffs on $16 billion worth of U.S. goods, including certain vehicles, fuel, and fiber optics. China said today it will retaliate against the latest round of U.S. tariffs on Chinese imports. Can China win a trade war? The Chinese Ministry of Commerce announced a 25% charge on $16 billion worth of U.S. goods. The 330 goods being targeted by China include vehicles such as large passenger cars and motorcycles. Various fuels are on the list, as well as fiber optic cables. China is also going after coal, grease, Vaseline, asphalt, and plastic products and recyclables. There are some issues that are facing China's economy and the question about them being able to win a long-term trade war. We have to look at the fact that their economy is slowing. They're facing what's called the middle income trap, as well as the Lewis turning point. And the Lewis turning point is a situation where your reserve of labor begins to shrink which pushes up wages and erodes the country's competitive advantage in labor-intensive industries. We'll have more on that as well. Lawsuit challenges administration's crackdown on asylum seekers. The ACLU is suing the U.S. government over its efforts to prevent immigrants from seeking asylum due to domestic and gang violence in their home countries. The ACLU's lawsuit asks a judge to invalidate Attorney General Jeff Sessions' June 11 decision to restrict the kinds of cases that qualify for asylum. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of 12 parents and children who the ACLU says were wrongly found not to have a credible fear of return. If Sessions' memo stands, the lawsuit argues people desperately seeking safety will be unlawfully deported to places where they fear they'll be kidnapped, raped, beaten, and killed. Asylum can be granted to someone who was persecuted in their home country or could be persecuted if forced to return. Thousands of people seek asylum each month at U.S. Customs and Border Protection stations along the southwest border. Most are from Central American countries torn apart by violence, gangs, and corruption. This suit comes at the same time that the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, filed a suit today in federal court on behalf of more than 10 Muslim travelers who alleged they faced harassment at airports and suffered other consequences because of being placed on a terror watch list. The plaintiffs are from Maryland, Florida, Michigan, Oregon, Kansas, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. Whatever happened to this thing I read somewhere about the presumption of innocence? Oh, that's a constitutional concept. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, some races are too close to call this evening as voters hit the polls yesterday in several states. Again, as I said earlier, in Ohio's 12th is too close to call, and Kansas is too close to call. Missouri voters have decided that Missouri is not going to be a right-to-work state, and Rashida Tlaib is the first Muslim woman to be elected to Congress after winning the Michigan Democratic primary. So what's going on here, and what are we to make of it? Well, for insight, we turn to my first guest. He is the host and executive producer of the Public Agenda podcast. He serves as regular contributor to TV One and the China Global Television Network. He is Ray Baker. Ray, welcome to The Critical Hour.
Dr. Leon, it's my pleasure to be here on The Critical Hour with you.
And Ray, it is more of my pleasure to have you. So we got a mutual admiration society. There we go. So the most notable contest is the special election of Ohio's 12th congressional district. A Republican, Troy Balderson, is holding a razor-thin margin over Democrat Danny O'Connor for the seat that's been vacated by Tat Tebery. Democrats were looking for a possible win in a district that they haven't won for decades. At the last report, Balderson carries a 1,754-vote lead with approximately 8,000 provisional ballots still outstanding. What do you make of what's going on in Ohio's 12th, and do you see that as sending a message across the country?
So I think the biggest question that you asked was the one that was your follow-up. Do I see this as sending a bigger message across the country? Democrats, since President Trump has been elected president of the United States, have been saying that they are intending to ride a blue wave and intend to turn these Trump-voting districts Democrat. But they keep coming close, but not quite close enough for the victory. Now, I know that the race in Ohio is too close to call officially. It looks as though the Republican candidate will get the win there, and Democrats are moving forward optimistic because, hey, we won, or we nearly won, in a place that Republicans have traditionally won by somewhere upwards of 20 to 25 points. But they also had this same thing in Georgia 6. And we know that Georgia 6 has Lucy McBath now running in the general election, and she's well known for being the mother of Jordan Davis, who's unfortunately shot and killed at a dispute at a gas station. But Democrats, if they are to be taken seriously about winning elections, just on that matter alone, need to actually start winning some of these rather than coming close. Because if that's the case, Democrats will be the United States horseshoe champion. The place where getting close gets you close enough.
The United States horseshoe and hand grenade champion.
Horseshoes and hand grenades.
That's what close gets you. So now let's move over to Kansas, because it's too close to call in the race for the Republican nomination for governor of Kansas. The race for the nomination is incredibly close. Current Governor Jeff Kohler is trailing Chris Kobach, the controversial Kansas Secretary of State, by just 191 votes, with all precincts reporting. But again, those pesky provisional ballots still have to be counted. That's a margin of 0.06% of all votes cast. So what does this tell you? And do you think the race is headed to a recount?
Well, the funny observation I have here, and the only reason we say it's funny, because as we know, we laugh to keep from crying. We know that as Black Americans, or else how would we have made it this far? The funny observation I have here is, who does a state turn to in the event that the elections, statewide elections, are questionable, problematic, have some sort of chaos, confusion, or need a resolution?
That was going to be my next question. Go right to it.
You turn to the Secretary of State, right?
Yes.
The Secretary of State in this case is Chris Kobach, the same Chris Kobach who is one of the gentlemen of who would have, at the least, in the most polite way you could say this, a conflict of interest. And the same Chris Kobach who was the commissioner or the chair of President Trump's Commission on Voting Integrity, the same one that had a report that there was no, there was a lack of evidence that showed that the voting in the United States had been compromised or that non-citizens were voting, and the same Chris Kobach who refused those results, did not believe the findings of the commission that he was the chair of, et cetera, et cetera. If anything...
Wait a minute. You left out one important point. The same Chris Kobach who created the cross-check program, which in fact disenfranchised millions of voters across this country.
Millions of voters across this country. A program that, if I'm not mistaken, he had auditioned in ways, one way or another, in his own state.
Correctamundo.
We now are going to turn to that person and look at and allow him and allow his office to oversee the fairness of those elections, but will have the audacity to invalidate another democracy in another nation to say as though their elections are somehow problematic, flawed, and should not be trusted. As Don King would say, God bless America.
And we have the same conflict in Georgia, where Republican gubernatorial candidate Brian Kemp, he's been asked to step down as Secretary of State for similar reasons. Possible conflict between the outcome of the election he is a candidate in as he runs against Democrat Stacey Abrams. And what we also know about what's happening in Georgia is Stacey Abrams created a group to increase voter registration. It was Brian Kemp and his office that accused Stacey Abrams' group of fraud and invalid. She turned in about 200,000, I think, generated approximately 200,000 new voters, and his office invalidated a number of those applications and accused her organization of fraud. There again, a conflict of interest. And in Georgia, by the way, I believe that the Secretary of State, historically, there is no constitutional provision for the Secretary of State to recuse himself or step down. But historically, that's what his predecessors have done.
His predecessors also have not taken chainsaws to stacks of paper to say they're ready to rip through or shred the regulations. They have not paraded around pickup trucks saying they're looking to, quote, round up illegals, close quote. And they historically have not had the opposite of President Obama and Arne Duncan's education policy, race to the top, a race to the bottom of moral behavior than we've seen before. At least folks were kind enough to use an American euphemism, release themselves on my leg and tell me it was raining. Folks now on the GOP in the United States are releasing themselves upon one leg and then calling it a day. One of the things that we see that becomes the most emblematic, as you allude to Georgia, of how far right politically, how far right socially, how far right racially the United States has moved, is that Stacey Abrams is painted as somehow a radical by a mere existence of being a black woman. Her politics and policies are standard fare for the American Democrat, and one might argue are a bit center left, if any way leaning. But because she has the audacity to be a black woman, she is now painted and believed in many circles in Georgia to be a radical candidate that Georgia should not and could not take a chance with. Good gracious, what's happening in America?
You know, Ray, what is really interesting to me is how you can turn on any of the major network channels you want to, MSNBC, CNN, Fox, if that is considered a network. Anyway, and you can get hours and hours and hours of discussion about Russian hacking in our election, Russian hacking in our election. We have to protect the sanctity of our electoral process, and we've got to protect ourselves against these pesky Russians. But nobody wants to talk about the Republicans. You don't have to look at the Russians and the Kremlin. All you've got to do is look at the Republicans and Kobach. And the other thing is, there should be a standing rule, a standing law, a standing provision that a Secretary of State in a state cannot oversee the outcome of an election in which he or she is a candidate. That to me, man, is just fundamental logic 101. But you don't hear anybody talking about this.
Because the United States has a way of framing things that have always been done as things that are acceptable. And things that may be new upon the screen, particularly things done by outside actors, are things that are unacceptable. If we spent all of our time engaging in and conversing about United States hypocrisy in the electoral system internationally, domestically, we would take all of the time that your program can offer. And I think what's valuable is if, as you alluded to, if folks are concerned about election tampering and interference, we need to be honest and give time to think about how much do we accuse someone for if whatever transgression was made is nothing but a mere pandering to the nation's worst values, as opposed to explicit behavior that the North Carolina Supreme Court said targeted with laser-like focus voter suppression of African Americans. If we are interested in sincerely protecting the sanctity and honesty of the election, that should be where our attention can start. That is not to say that you don't pay attention to what may seem to be outside interference into your electoral system, but the attention paid to who went in and hacked and changed actual votes is different from who's setting up troll farm accounts that really make people fire up their racism. Because those are two very different conversations. And until the United States has the degree of maturity to have those conversations and then talk about what the outcome is based on that observation, that analysis, and that conversation, we're really doing a dog and pony show where we chase our tail.
You are absolutely right. And then when you add to that, in my opinion, you can't morally have any indignation towards Russia about alleged interference in the American democratic process unless you look at what the United States is doing in Venezuela, unless you look at what the United States is doing in Ecuador, unless you look at what the United States is doing in Nicaragua, unless you look at what the United States did in Panama, tried to do in Cuba, and did in so many other Central and South American countries. We have been engaged in election tampering since the 1940s. So if the Russians were involved, all they did was take a page out of the American playbook and then work it a whole lot better using modern technology than the United States did.
I think that you hit on several things that I think are important to consider here. And one of those things is, you talk about, if we're going to talk about Russian interference, then we need to talk about America, what America is doing, and you named off the number of places in Central and Latin America. I'm grateful that you used the present tense doing, because many try to discourage what it is you were alluding to in the past as mere whataboutism, right? Well, what about this? What about that? You can't say we're talking about this. Stay focused. So in the midst of where we're focused on, the United States is committing those transgressions. Further, the transgression of, hey, don't you dislike your neighbor? Versus, hey, I'm kidnapping your democratically elected leader, seem to be two very different things and distinctions that we who are smart enough to walk and chew gum ought to be able to make. What that means is, if the allegations against the nation of Russia, the Russian Federation, if they are as the United States intelligence service, the intelligence officers are saying they are, Russians tapped white Americans and said, hey, those blacks, they sure are doing some things. And that riled everybody up. So even if we engage the ideas and conclusions of the United States foreign intelligence officers, doesn't that make the United States almost want to have shame that merely insisting other fellow citizens are becoming equal to you is enough to change and alter how one votes? I offer, Dr. Leon, the reason why we don't have that conversation is because the same folks who take the United States foreign intelligence officers at their word and take them so seriously also don't like to think that they and their loved ones and their community can be so easily manipulated to turn onto their worst moors. But history tells us, history told us, and if we do not correct history, history will again repeat and show us that Americans will and Americans did.
Ray Baker, how do people get access to the Public Agenda Podcast?
Public Agenda Podcast is available on SoundCloud. It's available on iTunes. We're really excited about our new season that'll be kicking off in the fall. A gentleman that some of your listeners may have heard of, the host of By Any Means Necessary, Eugene Perrier, will be one of our guests. We're talking about all of the important racial, political, social justice issues that you need to know here in the United States. If you're interested in allyship and solidarity, this is the place you want to go. Public Agenda Pod on Twitter. So you can follow me at Ray Baker Media on Twitter. And Dr. Lee and I appreciate the space and opportunity to converse with you, just like we used to do back in the old days over on Howard's campus, just like we did on the set of TV One. So good to hear from you again.
Well, this won't be the last. This is the first of many. You're in the cycle. You're in the rotation. Looking forward to having you back. Ray Baker, thanks, man. Thanks for coming to the Critical Hour.
Yes, sir.
All right. Have a good evening. All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I am your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. China announces 25% tariffs on $16 billion worth of U.S. goods, including certain vehicles, fuel, and fiber optics. China said today it will retaliate against the latest round of U.S. tariffs on Chinese imports. And the question really is, well, two questions. One, what's really behind all of this, and can China win a prolonged trade war? For insight into this and other issues, we turn to my first guest. He's a well-published academician, university professor, and accountant, professor in the Department of Accounting at California State University Fullerton, Dr. Paul Sheldon Foote. Greetings and welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much.
So give me some idea on the game of brinksmanship that really seems to be at play here in terms of the U.S. tariffs against China, and now China announcing 25% tariffs on $16 billion worth of U.S. goods.
Well, there are two different games. From the American side, the game is what was laid out by Professor Navarro in Death by China, is that we've lost many factories and employment by letting China get away with stealing our technology and having unfair trade arrangements. That's how we look at it, but the Chinese look at it a different way. The Chinese take a long view. about how they will be the dominant engine of the world economy and be militarily superior and economically superior to the United States. And as a communist totalitarian government, of course, they don't have to worry about this fall's elections or bickering among party politicians and like we do in this country. They can pursue a very long-term strategy, and that's what they're doing very well.
Talk a little bit about the Belt and Road Initiative and the Made in China 2025. Yeah, Made in China 2025 initiatives. I mean, China is really going full barrel all out, to your point, to become the world leader in industry, in production, and all of the countries that I can think of in the industrialized world are trying to be the biggest, the brightest, and the best. Why should we be mad at China for trying to do their part in contributing to the world economy?
It's not a question of contributing to the world economy. It's a question of who's going to dominate it.
Okay.
America, for decades, has enjoyed the trust of much of the world. The American dollar was regarded as something that held its value and that Americans were honest and kept their promises and so forth. But in recent years, unfortunately, with our endless wars and our not protecting the dollar, plus the sanctions that we are dishing out to many countries, we're losing the respect and faith of people around the world. And that's very vulnerable for us because for a very long time, many foreign governments and corporations would take out loans in U.S. dollars. And they'd have to pay them back in U.S. dollars, not in their local currency. And that's not easy to do. And so if you don't have a stable American currency, then you need to think about something else. And the Chinese have been pushing very hard for alternatives. For example, they have suggested that the International Monetary Fund's special drawing rights could be the alternative to the dollar. They have suggested that a gold-backed yuan could replace the dollar. The Chinese have been buying gold like crazy and saying, we will have a currency that stands for something. It won't be a fiat currency.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not talking about helping the world. They're talking about how they can replace us in the dominant position economically and militarily in the world.
With China's economy slowing, it is still growing, but it is slowing. With the impact that slowing of the economy has on the middle class, and with what's called, I think, the Lewis turning point, having to do with labor-intensive countries where labor becomes in short supply, thereby driving up wages, thereby making production costs more. If these factors are starting to impact the Chinese economy, can China engage in a prolonged tariff war with the United States?
Yes, they can, because they have one-party rule. You don't have opinion polls. You don't have late-night talk show hosts poking away at the president or other politicians and so forth in China. In fact, a Chinese professor was arrested just the other day because he had posted something online. They don't have to deal with the volatile public opinion that we do in this country. They can do what they want for a long period of time, and they won't have any problems that they can't deal with.
I've had a couple of different international news agencies bring me on programs and ask me, what is Donald Trump doing? And I tell them, when you all figure it out, let me know, because you're asking me to explain what I perceive to be and what many perceive to be irrational behavior. Do you see his behavior as being irrational, or do you see his behavior as being incredibly calculated, and he is pursuing an agenda that we're just not understanding or paying attention to?
Well, he knows what he's doing. He won the election because of that. If you look at the voting patterns, large percentages of labor union members voted for him. People who had never voted for a Republican in their lives voted for the first time for him. In spite of what the union leaders were recommending, they went with him.
I'm not talking about him as a politician. I'm talking about him on the international geopolitical space and the trade wars and the canceling of the Iran deal and the tearing up of a number of agreements, the Paris Accords and so on and so forth. I'm looking at that in terms of the geopolitical space.
You are, but he's not. He's looking only at the local market.
Okay.
He doesn't care about the rest of that, unfortunately. You know, over centuries and in recent decades, America built up a lot of goodwill around the world. I worked at the American Embassy in Iran, for example. I worked in corporations in the Middle East and North Africa and other places. There was a lot of goodwill toward this country, but that's gone. I mean, when we have endless wars for Israel, when we are sanctioning people over the place, threatening people, we've lost it. And someone wants to fill that vacuum, and the one who wants to fill it most is China.
There is no question that as the United States steps away, China steps in. In fact, there's been, with the election of President Xi Jinping, this whole change in the China mentality of being much more aggressive on the world stage instead of playing the role as the poor Chinese victim.
Oh, they've been very active on the world stage. You have the new Silk Route,
mm-hmm.
promises prosperity. They have a naval base in Djibouti in Africa. They leased a port in Pakistan. They have purchased or leased natural resource facilities in many places in the world. Well, we send soldiers to die around the world and blow money on military bases and so forth. They have spent their money very wisely and gained access to what they needed.
So in closing, really, you're saying that Donald Trump isn't that concerned about the international geopolitical space. He just wants to know how it's going to play in Sheboygan.
That's right. He plays the very short-term game for himself. Who will win in the congressional elections in November? Who will win the next presidential election? Those people, the rest of the people can't vote for or against him, so they don't matter.
Dr. Paul Sheldon Foote, thank you so much for your insight. Thank you so much for your analysis. I greatly appreciate you coming back to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you, sir. All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. New documents reveal how Trump's Election Integrity Commission engaged in a political self-promotional battle against non-citizen voting without ever establishing that it happened. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She's lead counsel in the Legal Defense Fund et al. Versus Trump et al., an ongoing lawsuit brought pursuant to the Constitution and Federal Advisory Committee Act that challenges President Trump's creation of the racially discriminatory Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. She is Natasha Merle. Welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. Commission member and Maine Secretary of State Matt Dunlap released a trove of commission documents after he sued to have a court release them, highlights that much of the commission's correspondence and activities were part of efforts by a tight circle of Republican officials, activists, researchers, and journalists to identify non-citizen voters. Tell us what you know.
That information was released, and that information, you know, was not surprising to our clients and to the attorneys at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. That is exactly what we had alleged in our complaint, that the commission was formed by the president, was not fairly balanced, but instead was created with the intent to manufacture evidence of voter fraud and in order to suppress Black and Latino voters.
Talk a bit about the whole vote fraud argument. I see it as a solution seeking a problem. It's a great talking point. Everyone wants a free and fair election. The problem is this great talking point and the rhetoric it generates results in solutions such as voter ID laws that solve a problem that does not exist and, in fact, seems to do the very opposite of what its stated purpose is because it disenfranchises the most vulnerable individuals in the electorate.
You're exactly correct. There is no evidence of widespread voter fraud, as has been posited by President Trump and Secretary of State Kobach.
In fact, if I could just jump in right there to that point, it's been a while since I looked at the number, but I want to say the last time I looked at the research, the percentage of vote fraud in this country was something along the lines of 0.00032 or something like that.
That's correct. It's incredibly small, given how many ballots have been cast in our history of elections.
Yeah, 10 cases in millions of votes, billions of votes cast.
Yes.
Okay.
And based on that, you know, very scant evidence, non-existent evidence of voter fraud, you're exactly correct. The commission intended to suppress voters from having access to the franchise.
So as the Legal Defense Fund, talk a bit about the case that you all, there are a couple of cases, I believe, that you all are engaged in, but you're the lead counsel in the Legal Defense Fund et al. Versus Trump et al. Talk about the relevance of the case since now the commission has been disbanded.
Yes. So LDF did bring a case against President Trump, Kobach, and the commission for the reasons, as I stated, that they were race discrimination, that they intended to suppress Black and Latino voters. There were other cases also brought against the commission, but our litigation was the only one that called out that, in actuality, this commission targeted Black and Latino voters. Since the commission was disbanded in January, however, LDF and the attorneys for the commission, we have come to a resolution in that the commission would be disbanded and the data that the commission had requested from all 50 states, to the extent that they received such data, that data would be destroyed.
Sorry, I lost the end of that. So the commission solicited data from the states. Now, I know that some states pushed back and refused to send the commission the data that they were requesting. So help me out. Did some states respond and others not? And if some states did, what then happened to the data?
Yes. So some states, you're correct. A lot of states pushed back and they were worried about releasing this data to the commission when the commission did not state what it intended to do with the data or how the data would be used. Many states did push back and did not send the data. Some states, however, did send the voter files or sent information that was publicly available. And in an agreement with the defendants, they agreed that such data would be destroyed, would not be used, would not be shared, and would not be kept by commission members since the disbandment of the commission.
And how do we know that the commission has lived up to that commitment when the commission was set up in the first place for nefarious purposes? That would tell me that at least the ones that set it up were engaged in nefarious activity. So how do we know we can trust that they have disposed of the information as they promised to?
They made representations to the federal court in our case. They made representations to the judge that they would destroy this data. And so we would have to go on that for now. And if it is uncovered at another time that they did not destroy the data or that the data was used by commission members or was kept by commission members, then we would definitely address that. But by now, they have made representations to the court to that effect.
Are you surprised that there has not been more public discussion about this commission, about your case, about the potential impact on upcoming elections, especially since we're so close to the midterms? Because other than the article in The Atlantic and a few other places, this has really not been, you know, there's been so much focus on alleged Russian hacking, and nobody's really paying attention to the president of the United States set up a commission to basically ruin our democracy, and nobody's talking about it. You know what? Before you answer that, let me ask you this. Am I overstating the potential damage that could have been done had the commission gone unchecked? Am I overstating that?
Not at all. Not at all. As you said in the beginning, they were seeking ways to suppress voters from casting ballots. And, you know, that is the most fundamental right that we have in this country. And if they had somehow succeeded, that most fundamental right would have been denied to eligible voters across the country. And so you are not at all overstating it. And that is also why we brought the case against the commission, because we understood the importance and the relevance that the president would put forth such a commission to investigate voters of color and to suppress their votes. So no, you're not overstating it, and it should be recognized. And I'm happy that you're talking about it, because I think people should be aware that, you know, there's a lot going on in the news, but it's also important to be aware that the president, that Secretary of State Kobach, what their true intentions were, and those true intentions remain.
So we're now coming up on November of 2018, our midterms, and what can we look to going forward? One of the issues that we always seem to be reactive on these vote fraud, voter suppression, well, vote fraud on behalf of what Kris Kobach and his cross-check program were doing across this country. That was vote fraud. But in terms of voter suppression and some of these other very important issues that are key to the sanctity and the security of our democracy, we seem to be on the reactive side, not the proactive side.
Yes, I mean, it's difficult times, and they're definitely, it's a very important right now, and LDF has always believed it's very important that every eligible voter cast a ballot. They're entitled to cast this ballot as their fundamental right, and we monitor and we watch for times where, you know, voter suppression may be occurring so that we can address that. But you're right, at this time, sometimes it does feel like we are a bit reactive because voting rights are being attacked from numerous fronts.
Well, for example, if we go back to 2000 and we look at the Florida election, Greg Palast, the brilliant investigative journalist, came up with the data, came up with the evidence that Jeb Bush had engaged a company called, I think it was Choice Point, to scrub the Florida election rolls of individuals that had been convicted of felonies, because felons are not allowed to vote in Florida. He had the evidence. I saw the database. He showed me the letter that Choice Point sent to Jeb Bush saying, your database is corrupt. You have individuals that are convicted of felonies 20 years in the future. He has the letter that Jeb Bush sent back to Choice Point saying, delete that column, continue with your work. We know that, for example, in Ohio, in the same election in 2000, Diebold, the company that makes the electronic voting machines, was sending machines into precincts already loaded with votes. And again, Greg Palast has the letter from Diebold to the Democratic committee in Ohio saying, we will see to it that the proper candidates win the election. And then we get to Kris Kobach in this last election with the cross-check program. Point being, the Republicans seem to be incredibly adept at moving the ball forward and expanding their programs. And this is kind of going back to my previous question. As we continue to play catch up, this is kind of rhetorical, but gosh, what are we looking for in the future?
Yeah, I hear you. It is quite frustrating when, you see how voting rights are being attacked different ways continuously. And here, as I said, at LDF, what we can do is to monitor and to address it when we see it, when it's raised to us, when communities raise it to us. when our allies raise it, that there are tactics going on, that we address it. But I understand that there are, people are out there who are intentionally attempting to suppress voters. And there's nothing we can do but keep addressing it.
Explain to the audience, please. We've used the abbreviation, the LDF, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Explain to the audience exactly who you are and what you do, because you are a separate entity from the NAACP, correct?
Yes, we are a separate entity than the NAACP. We're the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. We are Thurgood Marshall's law firm, the first Black Supreme Court justice in the United States. And we are attorneys, and we bring cases to protect, to further the Black voters, for example, and to protect their rights. We also have other issue areas that we cover, such as criminal justice and education and things of that nature.
You use the word Black voter, and I think it's important for the audience to understand that when you protect the rights of Black voters, you're protecting democracy. When you protect the rights of Black voters, you are protecting the rights of every single American citizen, whether they're in this country, whether they're stationed overseas and voting through provisional ballot, by seeing to it that the underserved are protected, whether it be the elderly, whether it be other ethnicities of color. You are protecting everybody's vote.
That's exactly correct. That's correct.
So what do we get to look forward to? Are there any other suits that are either on the docket right now, or do you have any other suits that are pending that people need to pay attention to? And how can people support your efforts?
So to your first question, in regards to litigation, you referred to litigation regarding voting rights. We are, LDS is litigating a case against the Secretary of State of Alabama because of their requirement that you must have ID in order, a photo ID in order to vote. And as we know in Alabama, Black and Latino voters are twice as likely to lack the required ID necessary to vote. Similar to Kris Kobach and the president, Alabama has alleged that that this is necessary to prevent voter fraud. Obviously, and there is no evidence of widespread impersonation voter fraud in Alabama. So we are challenging their photo ID requirement at this time. That's just one of our lawsuits to challenge voter suppression tactics that we have right now.
Now, explain to the audience why the photo ID is an issue. If I were to go and poll every person in this studio, let's say there are 50 people in this studio right now, they'd all have an ID. They'd either have a driver's license, they'd have a passport, or they would have a state-issued piece of ID with their picture on it. So explain to the audience why, particularly in places such as Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, South Carolina, a photo ID is a prohibitive item as it relates to voting.
Yes. So as you said, people in your office may have a photo ID, but as you're alluding to, that is not the case across the country. It is not the case that every eligible voter has the ID that would be required to vote. And as I stated, in Alabama, for example, Black and Latino voters are two times as likely to lack the required photo ID. And in total, around—
Why is that a issue with Black and Latino voters?
So there's a number of reasons. One of the big reasons are the burdens, such as the transportation burdens, the distance that people have to travel to get the photo ID, and poverty that prevents them from having the transportation, the lack of public transportation in Alabama that would prevent them from taking public transportation if they could afford it to get the ID. The cost of getting the photo ID itself is prohibitive for a number of eligible voters. So that's why they don't have the ID. It's not that they don't want to vote, that they don't want to participate in our democracy, is that they can't overcome the burdens that Alabama has put in their place in order to vote.
And it's also important to point out that again, voter impersonation is almost as rare as finding a woolly mammoth. The problems that people have at the polls now tend to be the precinct change from where they voted last time to where they're supposed to vote now. So they show up out of habit at the elementary school or the high school where they're used to voting, and the voting precinct has changed. It's those types of administrative issues that are impacting the vote. Rarely is someone going to try to vote as you when they're me. That's not going to happen.
That's absolutely correct. And I believe Alabama has only brought forth two cases of voter impersonation fraud. So neither do they have evidence of voter fraud in Alabama. And you're exactly correct. We're seeing polling precinct changes, long lines, malfunctioning machines. Those are the issues that need to be addressed and rectified. It's not that people are impersonating other voters in order to cast, you know, more than one ballot.
Natasha Merle, thank you so much from the Legal Defense and Education Fund at the NAACP. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming on the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Thanks for having me.
You know, folks, that last point that Natasha made in terms of voting machines, if the states spent half the money on seeing to it that the voter machines were operating properly and that the newest technologies were being employed all across the states, all across the districts, all across the precincts, so that you don't have old machines in the black communities in Detroit and you have the latest machines in Auburn Hills in Michigan. If the state spent the money ensuring that the processes were in place, we wouldn't have these issues and democracy would be in a much better circumstance. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you are informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.